Hello and welcome to Images, a public affairs program on KRWG that looks at the art, the flavor, the cultures, and the people of New Mexico. Hi, I'm Carrie Hamblin, the host of Images. Thanks for tuning in for an exploration into the hidden treasures of our area. If you've seen a statue, car, doorknob, streetlight, tree, or any other kind of structure or object covered in knitted panels, you've seen a yarn bomb. It's a trend that started in the mid-2000s where artists and knitters would completely encase an object in brightly colored yarn panels sewn together to fit the object just ever so snugly. On today's images, we feature a person who is spearheading her own yarn bomb of sorts of the NMSU campus. Stephanie L. Taylor is an assistant professor of modern and contemporary art history in the College of Arts and Sciences at New Mexico State. We will talk about the yarn bomb later in the program. But first, after a teaching appointment at the University of Indiana at Bloomington, Stephanie Taylor joined the art department at NMSU in 2001. Through her career, she has reviewed exhibits, explored modern and contemporary approaches to creating art, discussed surrealism, and challenged gender roles in photography, including the portrayal of women in the first issues of Playboy magazine. Later in our interview, we will talk about the photographs featured in early Playboy magazines, and we do talk about female nudity and what some may feel is a little graphic. While working toward her doctorate from Boston University, Stephanie Taylor came across the works of Joseph Cornell, who is best known for his works of art encased in ornate wooden boxes. She says it was just by happenstance that Joseph Cornell came up with this idea.
He said he saw sailors' boxes in a window in the Lower East Side one day, and that I would assume would be a sort of storage box, a small box that a sailor could take with them to sea and keep their scrimshaw or their pictures of their sweetheart or whatever a precious thing they had. But he said he saw those one day in a window and then immediately saw watch faces in another one, and he thought about it and he started thinking, why don't I put those together? When he originally started with the boxed format, he was always very proud. He said he was the one who invented the boxed format. I think something else that he wasn't saying was, of course, this was a very Victorian style of artwork, the bell jars that encased a flower design or a scrolled paperwork design. He grew up in the Victorian period, and I'm sure he saw shadow boxes, you know, in his grandmother's house, etc. He never talked about that as being an influence, but I think it was. Mm-hmm. So he started with found boxes, and then he started having a neighbor make boxes, a neighbor who was a woodworker make boxes for him, and eventually he learned how to use the saw, which is hilarious because he never used a camera. He had other people shoot film for him. He wasn't a guy who ever learned how to drive. I mean, he wasn't a real mechanical guy. So him using a buzzsaw just cracks me up.
Well, it seems like given that, you know, a hermit, he certainly wasn't somebody who socialized a great deal with
people.
Well,
he was.
But there was something about women in his life.
Right, right. Well, I have to correct you just on that because this is actually one thing that my scholarship has revealed that people don't talk about, which is this romanticized ideal of this hermit who never left his home in Queens and just stayed there making his boxes. You read his diaries. He was a compulsive diary maker, journalist, and he was out and about every day throughout his whole life. He started by working in Manhattan, so he'd go back and forth every day. In the 40s, he was making enough money with his art to stop working, and he still went back to Manhattan to visit galleries, to visit shops, to visit people. He was around, and then even as an older man, he would go to Queens to Main Street in Flushing and get a lot of material there. So he was out and about. He also was visited all of the time, and in the 60s, John Lennon and Yoko Ono show up in a limousine. Of course, John Lennon has to stay upstairs with mom in the kitchen while Yoko Ono gets invited down into the studio because he did like the girls. He liked the women a lot.
I read, why do you think then, given that he was so social, that he was portrayed as a hermit?
It's an interesting confluence. I think it's a very romantic notion, the idea of the artist in the studio. And so it's got roots back to the 18th century, if not before. But also I think the sealed nature of the boxes, the fact that the boxes are hermetically sealed. Oftentimes it's hermetic, the hermit idea. This shows up in the literature about him. And I think it was just a way to encapsulate him, pardon the pun, but, you know, a way to kind of understand him in a nutshell. And it just became a myth that was extended. Even artists, I spoke with Robert Indiana, the famous pop artist, once about Cornell. And Robert Indiana went on for 5 minutes about how he visited Cornell one day with a couple of other, James Rosenquist. I mean, he and three other pop artists went out to visit Cornell. And then he ended this 5-minute discussion by saying he was a real hermit. And I thought to myself, well, then how did he let, you know, hermits don't really invite you over to their house. Right. But Robert Indiana never got that connection that he that Cornell was actually there for people and enjoyed people. But I think it's the boxes, the sealed nature of the boxes.
Well, he certainly also was a eccentric in terms of his interactions with women
mm-hmm.
and if
children.
They had male friends, mm-hmm. he wouldn't, like
right.
you said, John Lennon had to stay upstairs
right.
with mom.
Right.
What was the explanation behind
he
that?
He was how do you put it? He was a gentleman, I think, in a way, but also fascinated by women, and usually women who were performers. He loved ballerinas. Romantic ballerinas from the 19th century, long dead, would appear to him in his fantasies, and he would write about meeting them on the Long Island Express train. You know, Fanny Cherito would take his ticket. He also knew some of the contemporary ballerinas in New York City. Allegra Kent was a woman who visited his house. He also loved movie stars. He made boxes for Lauren Bacall, for Hedy Lamarr, for many movie stars as well. I think he was really fascinated by the beauty of women and by the mystique of women. He didn't have lovers. He was never married. His mother lived with him his whole life, so that kind of put the kibosh on that. But I think he was more took a more romantic view of the female and the feminine. And they show up in his artwork. He constantly writes about them, but he didn't do anything about it in his life. Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm wondering, what was, you know, in terms of his work and the boxed pieces, make him stand out at the time in comparison to his contemporaries?
Right, right. He was an original American surrealist, and this was how his gallery owner billed him. Surrealism was really coming from France at that time, and in the 30s, many artists, André Breton, the Pope of Surrealists, Salvador Dali, many of the artists were fleeing France, of course, and settled in New York for the rest of the war. So he had connections. He knew these French artists, but his gallery owner, Julian Levy, was looking for an American surrealist, and that was a way of pitching Cornell. He also, I think, people responded to his innocence. He made objects that could be seen as toys. The boxes were meant to be held and moved. They often make noise, or objects move within them, you know, sand fountains, pinball machines. So they were meant to be manipulated by hand, and that had this sort of connection to childhood and toys and jouet mystique and that kind of thing. So he was different, but also really connecting to this surreal impulse that was showing up, not just in the galleries, but magazine spreads, movies. Alfred Hitchcock made Spellbound in the 30s, and it's all about a psychoanalysis. Ingrid Bergman, I would totally go to her for therapy, you know, and dream analysis and all of that. And so it was really in the pop culture as well. So he kind of just fit into all of that.
Well, something that you say in terms of him allowing for people to touch his work, I mean, was that something that was really common? Because normally you don't
touch them.
I mean, very few exhibits are tactile.
Right. And the best Cornell exhibits now with the boxes will put them in a space where people can walk around them completely. The backs are finished beautifully. They often have extra material or his writing on them. But to touch them is forbidden, right? For obvious reasons. Yeah, Cornell really wanted people to touch them. In fact, he had children in the neighborhood who would borrow his boxes like library books. They would come and say, I'm tired of this one, give me another one, and off they would trot with a box that today would cost, you know, $50,000, $100,000. It's quite nerve-wracking to hold one of these. I've gone to collectors' homes and they've just thrust them at me, and I think to myself, that's a year's salary for me if anything breaks. Mm-hmm. But they are really beautiful, and to hear them and to feel them. Actually, this is one reason I was originally attracted to them, even seeing them in slides, is their body scale. You know, you can think of holding them like a baby or like a teddy bear, right? And they're very connecting that way. They connect to your body. And I think Cornell understood that.
Well, so I'm wondering, how did looking at his work impact on how you looked at the creation of art from that point for you?
He was someone who really got me thinking about interdisciplinarity and intermedia and the idea of something not being one thing or another, which I think is very important in a lot of academic fields right now, but in studio production and in art history especially. So I think it really opened me up to think outside of these strict boundaries of painting, drawing, sculpture, because the box in many ways is pictorial, two-dimensional. He puts a lot of effort into that. But it's also three-dimensional, but it's not monumental, right? And it's also a toy, and it has to do with pop culture because he's making Hedy Lamarr boxes. And so it really sort of inspired me to really branch out and think across the boundaries that academia often sets up. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes me, I hope, a more flexible academician and art historian.
Our guest today on Images is Assistant Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art History at NMSU, Stephanie Taylor. Well, one of the many areas of your research and expertise is the portrayal of gender in the 1950s, mm-hmm. Particularly the way the women were represented in Playboy magazine. Right. And that was really at the time Playboy started.
Yeah.
And so what drew you to study and how women were portrayed in photo spreads?
Right, right. Playboy is a fascinating, I think, study because it did start in 1951. It really does encapsulate that period. There were men's magazines before it, of course, and there were some, they were called photo magazines, high-end ones that pictured nude women. There were some raunchier ones as well, but Playboy really was the first one to come into people's houses in a way that was more straightforward.
It's more commercially
exactly,
focused.
Exactly, and it was immediately a hit with the public, and it wasn't just the brown rapper crowd. It was coming into people's homes. I had the opportunity before I came to New Mexico State to teach at Indiana, University of Indiana in Bloomington, where the Kinsey Institute is located, and I took advantage of that and taught a course on the visual culture of the 1950s while I was there. And as research for that, I went to the Kinsey Institute and began looking through their archives. And of course, they have every issue of Playboy ever. And I thought, okay, I'll start looking at the 50s. And as I looked, I started noticing this really strange phenomenon, which was, in particular in the centerfold images, while there are beautiful images, I mean, these women are so gorgeous and the photography is so beautiful at that time, and that showed a lot of the body, they were very risque, the nipple on the breast was often obscured in some way. And this is before photo touching. This is, you know, they had to go to some effort to hide it because they're showing the rest of the breast.
Right.
Right. And so I started asking why that was. It wasn't because of the Comstock laws or because of the postal laws, because the genitals had to be covered up, but the breasts could be exposed at this time. And I got to thinking of what the breast meant in the 50s and also how it might be a game of peekaboo, or it might have just been the way that the men watching and looking at these images would have been most comfortable, because the nipple shows sexual arousal. And you wouldn't want a woman who is too forward that way, right? You like your passive women in the images. It shows nurturance. It's what the child breastfeeds them. And you don't want a mommy in those images. You already have a wife at home, most likely, who's having children for you. And it also might show too much aggressiveness. Like, it could be a gold digger, right? And there was a lot of the stories in the article.
The gold digger.
The gold digger. There's this great article in the 50s, like 53 it's published. And the gold digger was someone who was just after you for your money.
Mm-hmm.
And she would do whatever it took to get that money. And some of the cartoons are hilarious. You know, a wealthy banking man, you could tell, with a mustache and a cigar, gives a woman a gift. She's opening it. It's a sleeve of a fur coat. And the caption is, and you'll get the other sleeve in several months, right? This idea that it was about the man having control of the relationship, even if the woman was aggressive or was after you for your money. But, you know, you didn't want to fall prey to a gold digger. So part of, I think, this covering, this masking of the nipples. I mean, whether it's a feather floating in front of it or there's literally body makeup on it, which is very bizarre looking. I think part of it is that men were trying to retain control of how women were portrayed and how they perceived them. And that was the only way they could feel comfortable with them at that time. Things were changing for women.
And so you've got on one side that women are becoming empowered in essence, but then on the other hand, they're not so much empowered.
It's
and
true.
So, but there was a lot of work put into really staging.
Absolutely.
These photos.
Absolutely. And people would write in about it. I mean, some of the letters are hilarious. There's one centerfold where the woman is propped up in bed and she has a teacup, a coffee cup in one hand and a piece of toast in the other. And they are, and it's from profile and they're perfectly
placed.
She's
naked eating.
She has an open pajama top,
uh-huh.
And the toast and the cup are just perfectly aligned. And somebody wrote in and said, you know, I think your Playboy is the most I'd like to be her piece of toast, right? These people are writing in poetry about how they're noticing how carefully staged these images are. Yeah, so a lot of work went into it. And it becomes kind of a game. I think it's a little bit of a peekaboo game as well. I mean, I think that became exciting. But I counted nipples in the 50s. We did a nipple count. And, you know, it plummets. It starts up pretty high because, of course, the original Playboy centerfold was an image of Marilyn Monroe from the calendars. It was a stock image that Playboy, that Hugh Hefner purchased. But it was the image of her spread out on the red cloth, those really beautiful late 40s images. And her nipples are fully present in that. And when Playboy first started, they're using stock photography for the centerfold, for the sweetheart, they called it to start with. But once they get up and running and they have the money, they get their own studio, their own photographers, and they begin staging the centerfolds themselves. And the nipple exposure plummets. There's just nary a nipple in like 1954, 55. You can't find them. And then they slowly come back. They really start coming back in the 60s, as you can imagine, when things loosen up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's funny. It's looking for something that isn't there and asking why is often a great way to come at a cultural a cultural point.
Well, how did that compare to, I mean, there were other magazines at the time. So how did Playboy compare to the other magazines that would also come in brown paper wrappers?
Right, right. You know, Hugh Hefner put a lot of effort, and his editors put a lot of effort into distinguishing Playboy as the magazine for the wealthy, for the educated, for the urban. You know, the first editorial basically said, if you want to go splash around in streams, you know, pointing obliquely to these other naturalist magazines that would often have nude women in the fields, then you feel free to do that. We're going to be home in our bachelor pad listening to our hi-fi, talking to Nietzsche with a beautiful woman who we're then going to have sex with.
And smoking a pipe.
And smoking a pipe and wearing
a smoking jacket.
Yeah, exactly. The quilted smoking jacket. Exactly. Right. But they really took great pains to distinguish themselves as the more urbane image. Now, of course, you look at there's not a lot of data on the subscribers at that time. Subscriptions went through the roof from the very beginning. But you have to understand that, 80% of them are men living at home in a Levitt townhouse with a wife and 2.3 children and a full-time job, right? They're presenting a fantasy in the editorials just as they are in the centerfold. The whole thing is about creating a fantasy for these men who perhaps don't want to be married,
right?
You know, or stuck.
Well, how do you think that impacted how women are seen in the media today? Because, I mean, it really did really kind of set the bar in terms of how far you would go when we're talking about
nudity. I think that the idea on the face of it is that this begins an objectification of women. But, of course, we know from well before this that women were placed as sexual objects in films and in photographs. And, I mean, you look at 50s cinema, and it's all about the female body. You know, watch any Marilyn Monroe movie, and it's about her body. So I think in one way it hasn't had that much impact. It's sort of part of a continuum. But another way I think it can be really interesting is that women themselves were writing in to Playboy at this time saying, I'd like to be your next playmate. I'd like to be your centerfold. And these are women from the suburbs. These are women, some of them say, my husband took this photograph of me. He thinks I'm beautiful. He wants me there. And it exposes, I think, these myths we have of straight-laced 50s couples, which if you just scratch the surface a little bit, things were really changing in terms of gender relationships in this period. Married, single, Mad Men, the current TV show brings that out a little bit. BBC had a show called The Hour. It sort of gets at women were entering the workforce, and not just as secretaries at this time, but even as a secretary in a big city, they had a lot of freedom that they didn't have in the previous decade before the war, right? So I think the post-war gender relationships deserves a closer look. It's much more complicated than women are repressed and men repress them.
Our guest today on Images is Assistant Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art History at NMSU, Stephanie Taylor. Well, you have this broad range. I mean, you're looking at pieces of work by John Cornell, and then you're looking at photographs on how women are portrayed. And something that has been really kind of recent and has been kind of this trend across the country is yarn bombing.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, can you kind of explain the origins of yarn bombing and what it actually means? I mean, there are pictures all over the internet of it.
Right.
It's really fascinating. But I'm wondering where it started.
Sure. And anybody can Google yarn bombing and look at images and even videos. It's fabulous. Yarn bombing is a way of marking an urban space or a non-urban space with something beautiful, something colorful that's not permanent. So I often explain it as graffiti without the spray paint. Instead of a spray painted line that's permanent and you have to remove, you've got a knitted object, you've got a crocheted object. And who can be upset when your grandma, you know, your grandma's craft and homemade things are there in public? It started, I think, in 2005. There was a woman in Houston named Magda Sayegh, and she owned a store downtown Houston. And one day she decided that she wanted to beautify the store. So she started knitting cozies for her door handles. And from there, she started knitting cozies for the street lamp outside and the parking meters. And then other people found them and started coming to her, and there was sort of this yarn bombing posse, and they would go out late at night and put little antenna cozies, when cars used to have antennas. So they'd be, you know, beautifully patterned, and somebody would find that. Or they'd go to bars and leave little coasters behind. So it was sort of this surreptitious underground. No one knew who was doing it. This group now goes by Nitta Please. And Magda Sayegh has gone worldwide. She's yarn bombed the Great Wall of China. She's yarn bombed the Eiffel Tower. She's yarn bombed an entire bus in Mexico City with the help of plenty of other knitters. They're expressions to me of just pure color and joy. They're often just exuberant in their texture and their color. But they also bring domesticated women's work, right, handcrafts, into a public sphere, make them larger than life, show them as monumental, and bring this sort of craft into life. I mean, I think it's so important that people understand that art, contemporary art and craft, comes from people's connections to the world, not from that studio, as we talked about with Cornell, where you're just a hermit working by yourself.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that I think was most powerful and one of the most common images of a yarn bomb for me is the Bull at Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
That was completely encased, encompassed
in
like a one continuous yarn blanket.
This is Agata Olek, is this artist. I love her name. I believe that was Christmas Eve 2004, if I remember correctly, but people can look online and correct me. The Bull at Wall Street is the big metal, the bronze sculpture of the bull. It's a symbol of Wall Street at its strongest. And Agata Olek decided she wanted to give the city of New York a Christmas present. And so at Christmas Eve, I think 2004, she had created all of these crocheted panels. It's purple, it's pink, it's bright variegated colors. And she'd made it to specifically cover the bull. And she spent the whole night in a snowstorm. You can find video of this on YouTube, sewing this little cover, this cozy, on the full-size giant monumental bull sculpture. People came by and watched her. Everybody was interested. She did it as this really positive thing, like, here's a gift for the city. Let's keep the bull warm during the snowstorm. It was gone within 24 hours. It was removed by security. It was just literally cut right off of it. She got some great installation shots and video, but it is transgressing, yarn bombing often is. You don't often ask permission to yarn bomb. You just do it, right? And sometimes you have a political statement. One of my favorites is a woman named Ishtar did a pink hoodie for the Rocky Balboa sculpture that stands near the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And she decided she was really tired of tourists coming to have their picture taken with the Rocky sculpture and never going into the museum to see other art. So the slogan emblazoned on this pink hoodie is "Go see the art." And the Philadelphia Museum of Art didn't like it very much. They had it removed. But there's Rocky with his arms in the air wearing a pink hoodie that says, you know, go see the art, encouraging people to get involved.
And so what does it take? I mean, when we think about the bull, or we think about mm-hmm. a bus mm-hmm. or, you know, Rocky's hoodie.
Right.
What goes into that? Because, I mean, it's multiple panels, but you have to measure.
Right. Well, you have to, I think, understand the goal that you have, the shape, the size. The city bus was made with panels that people could make in any crochet or knit in any pattern, and then everything was stitched together directly onto the
bus. At the seams of where one
joined together mm-hmm. and stitched right onto it. Agata Olek spent a lot of time, I think, measuring the bowl and making these perfect little, it's sort of like an envelope for it. It fits really beautifully. Others are more freeform so that things can be draped or, wrapped around. There's some really beautiful tree wrapping that people can find online just to add brightness and color to the space. And you can find pictures of people sewing cozies onto parking meters and other urban structures as well.
So when did the idea, because you're doing something kind of similar with this, with the Heartlines Project. And so, you know, is this what led you to do this here on campus?
Right, right. You know, I taught a seminar on craft last spring semester with my art students. And one thing they got really interested in was how craft was becoming not only interesting for more contemporary artists, but was really stepping in to a public sphere. It wasn't really relegated to the living room, right? Someone knitting a sweater at home. And we got to looking at yarn bombings, and they expressed an interest in doing yarn bombing on campus, partially to show our connection to the campus community. My students often feel like no one knows where the art building is, no one knows what we do. Another thing they really wanted to explore was how we could connect to the Las Cruces community as well. So the idea for our yarn bombing does that both by we're getting a lot of volunteers from the community. We're always looking for more to help us create our Heartlines, as we're calling it. But also we're getting, we're going to donate the Heartlines back when we're done with our yarn bombing. We're going to sew them into blankets that we're then going to donate to local homeless shelters, daycare centers, et cetera. So we'll literally be giving back to the community as well.
And so when you first started this project and started this with your students, did you sit down in a planning and say, you know, instead of just yarn bombing, you know, the piece of structure right between here and the speech building.
Right.
You're going to do something more.
We are attempting to knit a 4-inch wide strip, or crochet for crocheters out there, a 4-inch wide, 1 mile long, 5,280 feet long strip that will shoot out from the art building, which is going to be the heart of an art community. It will shoot out in 3 strands from the art building to connect our community, the art community, to places on campus. So, for example, we'd like to have one of these Heartlines going from the printing press on the second floor of Williams Hall all the way over to Zuhl Library to show that books and images and printed material are made for communication but also for art as well. We'd like to go around the Saul LeWitt sculpture outside Milton Hall here over to some of the WPA murals at Breland Hall, which are just beautiful public art on campus. We'd like to shoot all the way over to the Honors Building to go from ceramics to, they have a copy of one of the ceramic Chinese warriors there standing in their lobby, and it's a fabulous object. I'm not sure people know it's there. So we'd like to connect our ceramics area to that. So we're really trying to think of how we get across the message of the arts of the heart. So we're calling it Heartlines. Show our connections to the community. We're waiting for the actual day. We're hoping for April 18th to have the bombing itself, but it's going to be up for 1 day. Students will unveil it at 7 in the morning. We'll have it down by 7 in the evening. It will be ephemeral. It will be these 4-inch wide Aggie red
crimson
strips. They're beautiful. Yeah. And they'll be going over sidewalks. They'll be going through cactus gardens. They'll be going through parking lots. We're just going to shoot these right on the ground. We're working with safety officers on this. But it really, we're hoping it brings people's attention to the beauty of the space as well and points out that New Mexico State is a really thriving arts community as well.
So how much yarn does that take?
I originally estimated about 500 skeins, and we're
skeins, and you're thinking
skeins,
of this,
and they're big double skeins. Yeah. These are balls of wool, basically, and we have about 300 skeins either finished or going. I'm looking always for more money to buy more skeins, and we have about 1,500 feet hand crafted now, crocheted and knitted. We have over 150 volunteers. These are students who've just learned how to knit here on campus from all departments. We've got faculty members. We've got some department chairs. But we also have a lot of community members who've called up, who've gotten in touch with me, who've come to Stitchin' Bitches that I've been at. These are great public meetings of crafters.
And that's
or Las Cruces that, Knitting
yeah,
Guild.
Those,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
So I'm getting invited to come speak. We went and talked to some students at Alma D'Art the other day. We're going to be on the downtown mall coming up here doing a mini yarn bombing and inviting people to volunteer with us as well. So crafters, I know you're out there and we could really use your hands before April.
Well, and also just the financial support, because this is something that is not readily available.
Exactly.
And whenever you do an art project, it's always nice to have supporters.
It is. And we've gotten great support. The Devastali Family Foundation has given us a really generous grant that's bought a lot of yarn for us. And it's also actually purchased a knitting machine that we're going to get cranked up and knitting out some of these Heartlines. ASA Architects here in town has offered to print up our brochure, which we'll have out hopefully in the next couple of weeks, which is really generous. And we've gotten smaller donations from different departments on campus, from the Arts and Sciences Dean, but we're always looking for more. The whole project is going to cost less than $4,000. And that's all of the yarn yarn, plus the sewing machines, the knitting machines we need to produce these blankets. This is start to finish. It's such a small amount of money for, I think, the positive impact it's going to have on the community and the positive message it's going to send for New Mexico State.
Well, that date, hopefully, to be set in April. Mm-hmm. When will the students actually start setting that stuff up? Because you want it from 7 to 7.
Right. We're going to get the students going about 6:30. They're going to roll it out like World War I soldiers rolled radio line, which is going to be great. We're going to have it documented. We think we have an airplane, a crop duster that's going to do some aerial views for us. And there are some photographs up on Facebook. If anybody wants to like Heartlines at NMSU, you can see some photographs of the students who are working with us, the community members, and also we did a little mini test in December and put some of the Heartlines outside the air building. And it's just gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's amazing. And it's totally recyclable, sustainable, and it's not going to make any permanent marks, we promise.
So how long have you been knitting?
I've been knitting since college. I taught myself how to knit in college. I worked at a craft store as an art student. I did custom framing, and I learned how there. And I knitted very badly for a long time. And now I have people I knit for, nieces and nephews. And so I've become a little bit more skilled since college.
Well, Stephanie Taylor, it's been so nice talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Carrie. And the best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Stephanie Taylor is an assistant professor of modern and contemporary art history at NMSU. She and a group of students and volunteers will be laying out the Crimson Heart Lines, connecting the art department to other areas on campus in April. Volunteer knitters and support crew are still needed, and more information can be found by contacting Stephanie Taylor at sltaylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, at NMSU. If you'd like to hear this program again or others, you can find them all on our website, krwg.org. Find images, and you'll see this program there for you. I'm Carrie Hamblin. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll tune in again next week at 5:30 for another Images, right before Prairie Home Companion on 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces.